on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Now, I got a bit too excited there for JJ finishing up. Thank you, JJ, for entertaining us all afternoon. It is St. Patrick's Day, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Ruby reviews the day at Cheltenham as Flooring Porter grabs syndicate success for Ireland.
As they jump over the last, and Flooring Porter under Danny Mullins, but now closing the gap, is tied out from the back of the field. But it is Flooring Porter who is going to retain his Stayers Hurdle title. Very close for the places in behind, with possibly just getting up for second place on the outside by Department Stone. Terrific front-running ride, and Flooring Porter has retained the Stayers Hurdle.
In rugby, Andy Farrell names his side for Ireland's Six Nations showdown with Scotland, which could deliver silverware.
Well, we've put ourselves in a position to do that, which is nice. But as you would expect me to say, it's just about this game, isn't it? About our preparation, and we've got a couple of days left, making sure that we prepare properly to be at our best. We're under no illusions that Scotland are going to be at the best. Nothing to lose. Great side coming to Aviva. Trying to spoil a little bit of the party.
Plus in soccer, I catch up with Shamrock Rovers manager Stephen Bradley, and in GAA, Galway's Conor Whelan and Tyrone's Kyle McShane have their say on the GPA-GAA dispute.
Last year when we Lily Colvin stuff, there was cuts and stuff, and the players were very happy to facilitate and participate in that, because obviously the difficult times you're in. But I think then there's an agreement that in place that once normality resumes, then you know, we go back to the way it was, that, you know, we'd be covered for sessions and all the rest. So
if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. I'm delighted to say that Cian Tracy of the Irish Independent joins me in studio, and that means we're going to be talking a lot of rugby today, Cian. It is just a couple of days away from that big Ireland Six Nations game against Scotland. Although today there still is a little bit of a focus on the England game, and the word from the Ireland camp today, according to your Twitter that I am reading this very second, is that the official feedback they received after last weekend's scrum disaster was that some decisions went against them when they shouldn't have.
Yeah, I don't think that's a surprise really to anyone, especially from, I guess, the coverage over the last few days with people who know about scrums, certainly a lot more about what goes on in the front row than I do. And, you know, even when you had someone like Nigel Owens coming out last week and saying that two or three of the penalties should have actually went to Ireland, not even just to England. So they're big things in the game. And, you know, Ireland were always, it's a process that every team follows after games. They get feedback from the referee, and I don't think it's a surprise that it's come back that a couple of decisions were wrong. And that's really important, I think, to probably, you know, settle any kind of nerves that may be surrounding the Irish scrum, be that internally or externally. So it'd be interesting. They didn't go into too much detail. I know people are probably curious, oh, which scrums are you talking about, or what exactly did Ireland do wrong? But you think back to the Lions tour and Rassie Rasmus's video, you know, in terms of like referees and stuff. So Ireland were never going to go down. I don't think we were going to see Andy Farrell releasing an hour long video of his criticisms of Matthew and Raynal.
I watched that though.
I know. Well, I think everyone watched it, yeah. But he paid the price for it in the end. But look, like I said, it's nothing unusual that a referee would give feedback, but I think it would definitely be welcomed because, like I said, it probably cements, like, Ireland don't have a bad scrum, even that they were missing Ronan Keller and Andrew Porter. Their scrum didn't turn bad overnight, so I think it was probably much needed feedback. And yeah, you'd expect a big performance now on Saturday against Scotland, particularly from the scrum.
Yeah, you're right about the confidence thing, all right, because there was so much focus on the fact that, as you said, it wasn't that they had a bad scrum, but it was just a bad day. And when the bad day is against England and the focus is on England having a good scrum as well, it is difficult to bounce back from that, I'd say.
It is, but that was one of the most positive aspects, I think, of the game, that like Ireland didn't have a scrum. They conceded 6 scrum penalties and a free kick, and they still managed to win the game. I know England were playing with 14 men for a lot of the game, but Ireland still found a way, and you know they weren't able to do that in Paris a few weeks ago earlier on in the tournament when they fell behind early on, like different type of game. But I think they'll have taken a huge amount of confidence that they got a big impact from the bench, something they didn't get against in that defeat to France, and they did pull clear of England in the end. And I think ultimately a couple of their own sloppy decision making and when to offload and not actually kind of cost them not pulling out a side earlier. So like that score I think could have been much, much bigger if Ireland were a little bit more clinical, a little bit more accurate. So I think that's why they're probably not pressing the panic button around the scrum. And certainly the word, like I said today from the camp, was that the feedback was from the referee that a couple of decisions should have went their way. So that probably just solidifies, you know, what they're doing, so they don't have to go away now this week and rip up the script and try and do something different in the scrum against Scotland.
That's all fair enough, but there is a conversation happening though, not off the back of the weekend, but definitely probably a bit of reaction to it, about the depth of the front five with the World Cup looming as well. Do you think there's an issue there, or are people just making a little bit too much of it?
I think there is an issue there. I don't even think it's necessarily around the scrum, because I think someone like Keane Healy is, what, like 34, 35 now, is still well capable of holding up a scrum. Okay, he had a bad day last week, but as we've just discussed, a couple of those decisions could have went Ireland's way. My concern would be, I just don't think Keane Healy or any of the other props below Andrew Porter and Tadhg Furlong can play the expansive game. And not that they can't play it, that sounds a bit harsh, but they're not as comfortable, I don't think, as playing it. And you see the way Ireland play now, Tadhg Furlong and Andrew Porter do far more than just hold up a scrum. And like Tadhg Furlong has pretty much redefined what a tight head prop does. So you were lucky when you had Andrew Porter behind him that you had two really comfortable tight heads who were on the ball. But as soon as Andrew Porter switched back to loosehead, that was going to always kind of upset the depth chart. So I think it is a concern. I think, you know, we touched on Keane Healy. Like, he'll be, you know, it's 18 months to the World Cup. That's still a lot. There's a lot of games to be played between now and then. You know, everyone's getting older every now and then. So I think there's a shortage, I think, on the loose head side. And I think if Tadhg Furlong was to go down in a World Cup pool stage and miss some games, I think you would certainly see people pressing the panic button. But look, Andy Farrell doesn't necessarily have a lot of other options that he can call upon. And that is probably the issue. He's not suddenly going to invent another Tadhg Furlong or Andrew Porter between now and the World Cup. So it's a case of trying to make the most of what you have. Like, hopefully someone like Tom O'Toole, by the time the World Cup comes around, like he can have more of a say. But I think certainly on the loose head side below Andrew Porter, there is a bit of a gap, which is probably natural when you consider that Andrew Porter is on his way to becoming the best loose heads in the world, and Tadhg Furlong probably is the best tight head in the world. So it's a difficult act to follow, to be fair.
Is Tadhg Furlong the most important player in that Ireland squad?
Arguably, yeah. I think the answer to that question was always Johnny Sexton, and like you'd still be tempted to say that, you know. I know it was against Italy, against 13 men, but he still came on and the attack looked much more fluid. Even when Ireland's attack fired in Twickenham last weekend, Johnny Sexton was at the heart of it, particularly in Jack Conan's try. I put a clip up on Twitter actually that I spotted it. The phase, so it was 13 phases, and on the 12th phase, you can see Johnny Sexton scanning off the ball, and you can see him looking. The ball is nowhere near where he's looking, but he's looking at the space, and less than 30 seconds later, one more phase, Ireland score in the space, and you can see him communicating to those outside in the back line. So he still sees the game, I think, differently to a lot of players. Joey Carberry, played really well in Paris, but I think Furlong, to get back to your original point, Furlong is just so, so important, because it's not just, like I said, about the scrum. Like, he's almost as good as some out halves, like in terms of his playmaking ability, and he's so comfortable offloading the ball. He wants to step up as first receiver, and that makes defences and attack very hard to read. So he's absolutely pivotal to the way Ireland play. Yeah.
So he's a baller.
He's a baller, absolute baller.
Okay, Kim, we will be getting into the Ireland-Scotland preview in a little while. But first of all, we are going to cross over to Ruby at Cheltenham. Well, a little bit earlier, I caught up with Ruby after another dramatic day.
Game on.
Racing.
Ruby, it was a bit of a mad day. I'm not even sure what the standout moment was, because there were so many of them. For you, though, what was it?
Oh, standout moments. I thought Alaho was brilliant. I thought Paul Townend picking himself off the floor to be as positive on Alaho was brilliant. I thought Florian Porter, Gavin Caldwell, what a change of performance. Danny Mullins, the skill, the execution of the ride was outstanding. They're probably the two, Marie, like, but it was a roller coaster day from start to finish. And, you know, I might as well keep going, like galloping the champ. I've been that soldier on more occasions than I would wish in anybody else. At the Cheltenham Festival, I'd been in front of Adam McCraw, Spinny, the Jew, Andy Power, and they fall at the last of the race in the bag. It's like the most soul-destroying feeling. But as a sports person, all you can do is analyse what you do, pick yourself up and go again. And that's exactly what Paul Townend did.
Yeah, I think everybody, when it happened, when Paul and Gallopin did fall at the last, just hands in front of the face. Like, for somebody like him to go through that and be able to pick himself up again, as you said, and bounce back on Alaho, like, it's phenomenal, really.
It is, but it's what sports people have to do. And I would have spoken a lot about different things in my life with Ronan O'Gara, and it's no different than him pulling on the number 10 jersey for Ireland, standing out and tweaking him and missing the first penalty. He has to go and kick the second one like it never happened. So, you know, being a jockey is the very same thing. When you fall like that, you just got to go and ride the next course. And maybe not kicking the first penalty, kicking the winning penalty to win the match, and you don't and you miss. It's probably at that magnitude if you're comparing them. But you just have to continue on. And look at the execution. And for Paul, and it can be hard for a jockey, because to analyse a replay or look back at it, you only have to close up the television of the race course to look at. You might get to see it, you might not get to see it. You're playing it back in your own mind. What did you do right? Did I do everything right? What did I do wrong? And, you know, you did everything right. You put the horse on the right side. The horse took off. Unfortunately, being a novice, the horse doesn't put his feet out quick enough and didn't land. But it wasn't Paul Townend's fault. But that was not him analysing what he did. And you have to get over that quickly and ride the next horse.
So it was nothing that Paul did then, really?
No, nothing. Nothing that Paul did. There will be thousands of people that will not believe that. But when you have to look at it as a professional, and what Paul Hellman did was perfect. So it's to, you know, obviously Willie would have spoken to him, and David Casey would have spoken to him. It's to drum straight back into him. Paul, what you did was correct. It was spot on. There's nothing more you could have done. Now just go and write the next one. And, you know, Paul Hellman proved he could.
I know you said it happened to you a few times with the likes of Annie Power and Benny DiGio. Was Annie Power the worst one?
Yeah, because it was the last race.
There was nothing you could do.
And it was going to be a four-timer. And I came back the next day, I didn't ride a winner, but I rode two winners then on the Thursday. So, you know what I mean? As a jockey, in the fall, your last ride of the day is always the worst time to get one, because you have to wait till the next day to go and put it right in your own mind. You know, that's just life. You got to deal with these things.
Now, I know Bob Olinger did go on and win, but Rachel Blackmore wasn't too happy with the ride in general. What went wrong for Bob Olinger, even though the horse won?
What went wrong from what I thought could go wrong from, it's probably why we took him on, why Willie Mullins took him on, because he's just not a natural of offences. And it was the sixth last, the fifth last, and the fourth last. Paul Townend applied the pressure on Gallop and Deschamps. He outjumped Bob Olinger at those three crucial fences when you're climbing the hill and the first one on the descent. They just took the steam out of Bob Olinger at the right time.
Okay, Alaho, I know that you were pretty certain that Alaho was going to do it, but it did feel like there was an awful lot more pressure on then on Paul Townend after what had happened with Gallopin, but Alaho delivered.
Yeah, he did deliver, and the crowd woke him up. I'd been a little concerned about him at home that he was going quite quiet and relaxed, and Alaho's trying to race and he's performed him off from the start, but the crowd woke him up. He bucked out in front with a really good gallop, jumped from fence to fence, and the pressure was on. I mean, last year was on Paul along with Gallop in the show, but last year he put in that amazing performance, but under Rachel Blackmore, Paul had to prove he could get the same out of Alaho, and he did. And it was fabulous to watch. He was a great Irish winner, and yeah, Alaho was brilliant. I mean, it's a new race and a middle distance, but, you know, Alaho is probably one of the best 2.5 milers we've ever had.
Okay, talk to us about Flooring Porter. I know that you were in the champ camp ahead of the Stairs, but you did mention that if Flooring Porter could settle, that he would go on and win. But I'd say Danny Mullins had a lot to do with that as well.
Huge amount. And so did Gavin Cromwell, to be fair to him. You know, he had the horse in great condition, trained at a minute, and Danny got it right. Look, pace and front running and getting your furlongs, each furlong at the correct speed, is judgment on a horse. You can't just look at your wrist to see what your watch says, because you can't press it jumping off. So you don't have a watch. So you're clocking it in your own head, in your own mind, what speed you're going. If you look up at the screens, you don't see time, so you don't know what. You can't be certain of what speed you're doing, so it's only ever judgment. And Danny judged it brilliantly from the front. And he got to the top of the hill in a championship race and had the confidence to slow the race down. And he slowed all the riders down behind him, stacked them up behind him down the hill, jumped the second last really well, but didn't accelerate when he landed. He sat again and slowed everyone behind him for a second time before he started to quicken when he got straight. And he built the momentum from there. Challengers did come behind him. He got a brilliant jump at the last. Flooring Porter went left like he can. Then he really quickly got his left hand over onto his right rein to straighten him. And the horse accelerated away to win. It was a really skillful ride and was really well executed. And, you know, I'm delighted with Danny Mullins because he's never had a job as a first jockey for anybody. Yet this season he's won the King George for Willie Mullins. You've got Paul Town and Dave Leperstown. And he's gone and won on Flooring Porter for Gavin Cromwell, whom he doesn't even work for. You know, he's a really hard-working guy, and it has to be. He earns every success he gets. He earns, and you'll be thrilled for him for every good day he has.
Yeah, just we were watching at home and we were just remarking afterwards just how well he even spoke in the post-race interview, deflecting straight to Gavin Cromwell and the work that he had done with Flooring Porter.
Yeah, exactly. But that's probably Danny's understanding of the sport as well. I mean, Danny is a jockey, but he started his life as a trainer's son. So he understands the work and the commitment that trainers have to put in to race horses. And trainers have far more to do with it than jockeys. And Danny would understand that, being a trainer's son. I mean, as a jockey, you turn up at the races, you ride them, you get off them and you go home. Trainers have the horses 24 hours a day. They live with them. It's their business. It's their life. And Danny was able to, as you said, deflected to Gavin Cromwell, but do so in a good way, because he would have understood even the job that Gavin Cromwell had done.
I wasn't sure that the owners and connections were going to put him back down on the ground, though. It was pretty wild.
It was wild, but it was lovely to see. And even some of the people from Galway who were over, Brian Gleeson interviewed them. One man had off to a bookmaker with Brian Gleeson, had his £640 sterling on him, and Brian Gleeson was saying to him, why 640? And he said, we've got it all I have. He had a whole lot of fights and once. He got 3,800 and whatever it was. But look, it was a magical day.
It was, and it was actually great TV as well. Like, even though I wasn't there, like, it was just still, as you said, a roller coaster, and you could get a real sense of the atmosphere over there. Just seemed absolutely amazing. And it's not done yet, Ruby. Another day tomorrow. So let's start with the Triumph Hurdle. I know that you had thought there's not much really between Pied Piper and Vauban.
No, there's not a whole pile, but the sun has started to shine again, Marie, and obviously Cheltenham, and it's a difficult one to explain, but there's two tracks in Cheltenham, and we've moved on to a different track for Friday and Saturday. And Thursday and Friday even, but the new course, which is Thursday and Fridays, doesn't have water applied in the autumn to make it safe to race on. So by not having that water applied in the autumn, it didn't get as soft when the rain fell yesterday. We saw that with today's results, and it will have dried even more by tomorrow. My worries this morning were that the ground would be too soft for Vauban, but I don't think it will be. I think the ground will be ideal for him tomorrow. And with the form Willie's horses are in, he could take a little bit of beating.
In the Albert Bartlett Novices Hurdle, I know you were in the Hillcrest camp for quite a while now. Are you still in it?
I am. I would have preferred if Ginto had run against Sir Gerhard yesterday. I think he's a very good horse of Gordon Elliott's, but he didn't. He runs tomorrow, and I have huge respect for him. But yeah, I'm still in the Hillcrest camp. I think he's a horse with a massive future. I think Henry Daly, could be a big day for him, for the late Trevor Hemmings as well, whose colours he runs in. And Hillcrest looks a real star of the future. And, you know, good novices turn into championship horses, so hopefully this fella will be one as well.
Okay, talk us through the Gold Cup.
How is this going to play out, do you think?
But there isn't a natural front runner in the race, so it could be a tactical enough affair. And, you know, it's hard to know. Between David Russell, Robbie Power, and Paul Towner, they ride like Galvin, Manila Indo, and Alvin Fono. They're really strong stairs. So somewhere between the three of them, one of them is going to have to make sure this is a strongly run race and try and draw the speed out of a Plutar and Protectorat. So, look, one of those guys this season is contemplating making a big decision in tomorrow's Gold Cup, but one, if not two of them, needs to make sure it's a stamina contest. You know, Rachel got lucky today on Bob Olinger, but I think she was unlucky last year when she picked the wrong one of the Gold Cups. She rode a Plutar instead of the Manila Indo. I don't think Conflated really did Manila Indo's form any good today. I think Conflated was well beaten when he fell behind Alejandro the right there. That's Manila Indo's form. So I'm still fighting with a Plutar, Marie. I think he was brilliant in Haydock. I think if Rachel rode with the differently, he would have won a Leopardstown at Christmas and beaten Galvin. So I'm going to side with a Plutar and ground that's going to be drying all the time.
In the Fox Hunters, do you think Billaway will make it third time lucky?
I hope he does. I hope he does, but I said he went on top of lots of form, Marie. I'm not going to pretend that I am an expert on point-to-point or hunter-chase form, and all I know is that Billaway is in really good form at home. He wears headgear, which will suit him, make him concentrate more, and hopefully that can make him good enough.
And just finally then, the Mrs. Paddy Power Mare's Chase, is it Ellie May for you?
It is Ellie May. She has Mount Ida and Concertista and Zambella probably to beat, but I thought she was unlucky here last year, and hopefully she'll go one better this year and round out the week on a high for Willie Mullins and Mark Walsh.
Okay, well, now you need to round out the week on a high for us, Ruby. Give us one tip.
Well, it's a race we didn't even mention, Marie, in the County Hurdle, which is the second race tomorrow afternoon. Horse called Statement, and Keane get the expenses for the bank holiday weekend.
Okay, perfect. Ruby, thank you so much, and I will talk to you tomorrow.
Game on.
Racing.
RTE.
2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. I'm delighted to say that Cian Tracy is still with me in studio. Cian, did you spend St. Patrick's Day sitting around watching Cheltenham, or were you working, preparing for the big Ireland-Scotland game?
Yeah, I wish I was sitting around or sitting in a pub, more likely, watching Cheltenham. Yeah, no, it was a busy day with press conferences with the Ireland under-20s. It was on this morning, as well as Andy Farrell. So the team naming day is always a busy day, but I got bits and pieces of it all right. I wouldn't claim to be a big horse racing fan at all, but I am interested in it. Probably got more interested in the last few years. Just, I don't know, it's so different to everything else. I'm fascinated by the tactics of someone sitting on a horse and the horse and the jockey working in tandem. I have a soft spot for Gavin Cromwell, actually, because and I was delighted to see Flooring Porter win, because in 2018... I was flying to Chicago to cover Ireland. We're playing Italy in a November international. I don't know if many people remember that. Jordan Larmour scored a hat-trick and everyone thought he was going to be the best player ever. Yeah. Yeah. So Ireland went back there after they'd beaten the All Blacks, obviously, a few years previously. But anyway, I was sitting next to a lovely gentleman on the plane, and obviously the flight from Dublin to Chicago was pretty long, so we had plenty of time to be talking, and it turned out it was Gavin Cromwell's uncle who was on his way over. I think they were going to the Breeders' Cup. So really interesting, like, and he was just talking about, you know, how his operation and stuff. And I've never actually been to a stables or, you know, like Willie Mullins yard or something like that. And I would be really interested to see like how they operate and stuff. So that's my kind of that's why I have a soft spot for Gavin Cromwell and Flooring Porter.
Well, he did a great job today, and Ruby mentioned him there a little bit earlier, and so did Danny Mullins after he won on Flooring Porter. He straight away started speaking about Gavin and the job that he did, and the perfect preparation that he put in place for Flooring Porter, bringing him over a little bit earlier in the week, because he needed it. And he said that Gavin Cromwell will have a lot of say in Cheltenham over the next few years, so it might be no harm to get that guy's number. You can hit us up with all the tips. We're going to move on to the rugby in just a second, but first of all, we have a text in from somebody asking us to congratulate Niall Moran on Ard Skull Rish winning the All-Ireland
Ireland beating St Kieran 60 years since a Limerick school won, and that was Limerick CBS, and I think it was Eamon Cregan was involved there by the texter there. I'll have to get a little bit more information on that. But Cian, you're a Limerick man?
I am not an art school man. It's actually been a big week for Limerick schools because Crescent Comp won the Senior Cup. I was in Munchins, so while you're delighted to see Limerick schools doing well, you'd prefer if it was Munchins. But yeah, that's an incredible achievement. Unbelievable. Like, art school are one of those schools who always try and juggle the rugby and the soccer. They've obviously, you know, Paul O'Connell is by far the most kind of famous rugby head to come out of Ardskull. But in the last 2 years, you've had Dave Kilcoyne and Craig Casey more recently. So it's always impressive what they do, because normally, as you know yourself, one school is kind of one sport or the other. Mm-hmm. So to be able to juggle both successfully is absolutely brilliant. It's great to see them win. Like I said, it caps off a good week for Limerick schools.
Yeah, I would be quite familiar with the school system down there because my dad was a PE teacher in St. Clements. So was very much, and was a selector on the Munster School team with Declan Kidney, so we were often brought to Munster schools matches and that. But back then, Ardskull Reach were very much a rugby school, but it really has evolved. I'd say a lot of pupils came in from the likes of Cratlow and that as well, and did it, and obviously Niall and a lot of the teachers brought the hurling to the fore. But like, as from your point of view, being a rugby man, when you see GAA coming to the fore in a traditional rugby school, does it raise a few eyebrows?
Well, it probably does, because, I mean, Limerick rugby has probably been on the slide for the last few years, even in terms of AIL rugby. And look, this is definitely a conversation for another day. Like, it's so deep, but there's been loads of reasons for that. Like, lots of people have left Limerick, moved out of Limerick for jobs. Like, I mean, I'm up here in Dublin, you know. So that's obviously had an effect as well. But I definitely think there's been green shoots in terms of especially Limerick. And look, you look at the success of the hurlers, the Limerick hurlers, and it's not just them winning All-Irelands, but it's the way they play. No more than when you look at the current Ireland rugby team. I think young people are inspired by when you see success, but also playing in a really attractive way. So it's only natural, I think, that young girls and boys in Limerick have, a lot of them have certainly probably been attracted more to hurling and GAA over the last few years. But I mean, with Comp winning the Senior Cup, like I said, this week, you know, if Munster can kind of get back on track and finally get over the hurdle and win some silverware, I think you'd see that kind of happen, because it does tend to work in waves. As big as Limerick as a city is, it's funny, usually you have like one or the other, like Munster rugby or Limerick kind of hurlers are on top. So I suppose the ideal scenario is to have both of them successful at the same time, which is difficult because you just don't have like the playing numbers like you do in a Dublin or...
Yeah, okay. Well, it is definitely interesting. And as you said, probably a conversation for another day, but there's definitely an interesting conversation to be had on it. Right, let's get into the Ireland-Scotland game. And we may as well pick up with where we left off from the top of the show and just talking about Ireland's front row. So Andy Farrell did name his team today. The front row remains intact despite their struggles the last day. And we went through that. Keane, you outlined the fact that they just had a bad day, that they weren't a bad scrum. Well, Andy Farrell did speak to Michael Corcoran about it a little bit earlier. Let's hear from him.
Good learning. Good learnings all round for us and for the officials. So we're happy with the feedback that we got. So the focus is has been just about us making sure that we get our own house in order.
And just in relation to the backs, obviously Andrew Conway up with that knee, Nigel McHanson, there's a lot of competition for those back three positions anyway, isn't there?
There is, which is great, isn't it? You know, you're always trying to build in every position, but the thoroughbreds there in the back three, they're the ones that tend to break from time to time, and it's always good to have some strength and depth there. And look, he's great. I think Max done unbelievably well. Robert Balakoon coming into camp for 8 weeks, you know, he's going to grow from that experience as well. So long may that continue.
So Mac Hansen is back on the Ireland wing after Andrew Cooney picked up a knee injury. What's the most competitive line, do you think, out there?
In terms of position?
Yeah.
Yeah, the back three is pretty competitive at the moment. I think Mac Hansen would have been really disappointed to have missed out in the England game last week. God, it's been some rise for him. I don't think everyone knows his backstory at this point, how he's picked up in Andy Friend, the Connacht head coaches. His son used to work in a bar in Australia, and that's how he got picked up. But he's just taken to it so impressively, really laid back, relaxed character, and I think that's been reflected in his performances. But look, Andrew Conway has been such a reliable performer for Ireland over the years, and like going to Twickenham, I personally wasn't that surprised that he came back in, but he misses out this weekend, like you said, with a knee injury. But I don't think Mac Hansen coming into the back three certainly doesn't weaken them, and if anything, it's no harm to maybe freshen it up a little bit, because I think Andy Farrell sees Mac Hansen as a guy who's going to play a key role in a World Cup squad, because we've only seen him on the wing for Ireland, but he can play at out half. He can play at fullback. So a guy like that is going to be really important when it comes down to, you know, like nailing down numbers for a World Cup squad, like I said. So yeah, the back three is certainly really competitive. I think it was probably a 50-50 call between Bundy Aki and Robbie Henshaw, I'd say. I personally thought they might bring back Robbie Henshaw again just to freshen it up. I thought Henshaw was outstanding off the bench last week. I didn't think Aki was poor by any means, but he probably didn't have as big of a game as he might have hoped. So that was probably a 50-50 call, but what a position to be in. Like, you think back to last year, Robbie Henshaw was the best Irish player, outstanding, went on the Lions tour, started all three tests, and was one of the very few players who came back from that Lions tour with his reputation enhanced. So he's had a tricky start to the season. He's had a few injuries, COVID and things like that. So Bundy Aki has been such a reliable performer as well, like Andrew Conway over the years, and like, you know what you get from him. But I think I was actually speaking to him as well today, and we'll have a piece in tomorrow's Irish Independent with him, that there was a criticism of Bundy Aki, I think, for a long time within the Irish setup, that he was a bit of a one-trick pony, and I say that term loosely, that we just didn't see enough of maybe his passing game and his playmaking game. And I think that was a little unfair, because I just don't think the role that he was being asked to play allowed him to express himself that much. So I think Andy Farrell and Mike Katz's attacking game plan does allow him to do that, and we've seen that throughout the course of the Six Nations. So it's a brilliant headache to have, isn't it? I mean, you're choosing between a fit Bundy Aki and a fit Robbie Henshaw, which really doesn't happen that often, because this has been, it was a problem that, not a problem, but like, it was an issue that Joe Schmidt had during his time in charge, but it became less so because it was very rare that you had Gary Ringrose as well as the two others fit all the time. So it's a brilliant headache to have.
Yeah, it is. And long may it last. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. As you said, there's still a little bit to go before we get to a World Cup, and keeping everybody fit and healthy and being able to have these conversations leading into that is no doubt where Andy Farrell wants to be. Johnny Sexton back in again. No surprise, really.
No, I mean, it's important to remember that there's silverware on the line this weekend. You know, Ireland are going for a triple crown, and it hasn't happened in a while, and Ireland actually haven't won silverware on home soil since, I think, is it 2000? Yeah, it's been a long time ago anyway. So, like, it's funny, like, you think back to, I remember in 2018 when Ireland won the Grand Slam, one of the coldest days ever, St. Patrick's Day, actually, in Twickenham. It was an incredible occasion, but you could always just wonder, like, oh, what would that have been like if it was in Dublin? Now, they're not going for a Grand Slam this weekend. If they beat Scotland, they're guaranteed the Triple Crown, but there's potentially a Six Nations title on the line. I mean, Ireland, every Ireland supporter is going to be shouting for England this weekend, which is a strange situation to be in. So Ireland need a massive favour from England in Paris, but they also need to keep up their side of the bargain, I think, by not only beating Scotland, but I think this Scotland team are really there for the taking, and Ireland should probably be, definitely won't admit it, but I think a bonus point is definitely possible against this Scotland team.
It's really interesting in Scotland team without Finn Russell in it, and Andy Farrell was asked about it and how Ireland, what they do with their approach when you have Blair Kinghorn in there instead of Finn Russell. He was talking to Michael Corcoran about it a little bit earlier as well.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Surprised? Yes and no. I mean, I think everyone was expecting Finn to play. He's a great player. But Blair, I mean, I watched the Connacht game and he was the best player on the field by a country mile. So we know him well. We know his strengths. very dangerous ball in hand, obviously takes the line on, very dangerous counter-attack wise, good passing game, good kicking game as well, and it's a big game for him, obviously, coming over to the Aviva, but I suppose Greg has had a look at him and picked on form because his last game for Edinburgh was outstanding.
Which is a better option for Ireland to be facing, Blair or Finn Russell?
Oh, it's no-brainer, Blair Kinghorn. There was kind of a bit of murmurings throughout the week that this could happen, so it doesn't make it any less of a shock, but God, they're putting a lot of stock in a URC game, which Connacht, I think Andy Friend and the players would admit, was one of their worst performances for a long, long time. Fell off so many tackles, and I would fancy myself nearly even to have looked good when the defence was so passive. So Blair Kinghorn looked like Dan Carter in his prime, and God, like, it's a massive step up, not just to go to international rugby, but to come over to Dublin, where Ireland are very tough to beat at the Aviva Stadium. So I think Andy Farrell and the Ireland players will be licking their lips at this team selection. It's a brave call by Gregor Townsend, but if it backfires, I think the backlash in Scotland will be incredible. I think there's already mounting pressure. Scotland have flattered to deceive once again this year. And even you think back to, you know, I touched on Robbie Henshaw on the Lions tour, and you think back to that third test, and like all the calls were, you know, for Finn Russell to have more of an impact, and he came on and it was almost like he was perceived as the saviour of the tour because he showed that, like, you know, these sort of free spirits can still, you know, thrive within a really rigid and kind of boring game plan, if you want of a better term, for what the Lions were playing against South Africa. So he's come back and I really felt like, you know, it could be a time for him to kick on, but he's sort of symptomatic of, I guess, Scotland in general, that just when you think they've clicked, they go backwards again. And probably doesn't look in the greatest nick. He was really poor a couple of weeks ago, as was highlighted. When your main playmaker and your main player, like, I mean, playing over in Racing and, you know, like a big club, and when he's not firing, I just don't think Scotland have much of a chance of firing either. So it's a massive statement by Gregor Townsend to take him out of the team, because you remember back in 2020, I think it was, they had a massive fallout, Gregor Townsend and Finn Russell, and it took them a long time to...
Standoff, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was very messy. So there's a bit of history there. So I would love to have been a fly on the wall when Gregor Townsend told Finn Russell this week that he's going to be on the bench for the last Six Nations game. And a guy, so in case anyone doesn't know, Blair Kinghorn has only started one game at out half. He's a fullback who can play on the wing. It's a big, big difference between playing fullback for Edinburgh in the URC and playing out half for Scotland in the Six Nations. He started out half against Tonga back in November. So I wouldn't imagine Finn Russell was jumping for joy, number one, when he was told he was being dropped, but number two, he's being dropped for a guy who's trying to be shoehorned into a position that he hasn't played. And he's a bit of an unorthodox 10 as well. Like, he's a big, rangy guy, so he'll pose different kind of threats that Finn Russell would have. But I mean, in terms of like Andy Farrell and Simon Easterby setting up the Ireland defence, I think they'll be a lot happier to see Blair Kinghorn there rather than Finn Russell, who is capable of pulling a rabbit out of a hat.
Okay, so are you predicting it'll be relatively straightforward for Ireland against Scotland?
I think it should be. It was interesting. I think the bookies make them 17-point favourites, and that went up 2 points after the teams were named today. So I think that sounds about right. I mean, you're never going to hear an Ireland team coming out and saying, other than talking up the opposition. Mm-hmm. But I think even if you listen to the Scottish media, like, they're pretty worried. I don't think this is me being like an arrogant Irish man or anything like that. I think the Scots are pretty worried coming over here as well. Like, I mean, their defence was one of the things that was really impressive under Steve Tandy, who was also on the Lions tour, but that's kind of fallen apart as well. Like, Italy last week scored, I think it was 3 tries, so they are going to pass up opportunities, and Ireland's attack is humming at the moment. Like I said, they made at times last week made hard work of it, but it was kind of their own errors. But I'd expect their accuracy, and I'd expect them to be way more clinical on Saturday. And like I said earlier, I think Ireland should be targeting a bonus point, because look, they want to put as much pressure as possible on this French team. like, I was in Paris a few weeks ago for Ireland-France, and it was an incredible occasion, a packed Stade de France. It's like, from a neutral, when you take yourself away from it all, it's incredible just to see French rugby back, but it's kind of like, be careful what you wish for as well. But when you consider that next year's World Cup is going to be on in France as well, I really think Saturday night is going to have a major bearing, because the weight of expectation on this French team is huge. No matter what happens at the weekend, the weight of expectation will still be huge come October 2022. But if France can deliver under the pressure, and to be fair, there's nothing to suggest that they can't. They've been really, really good throughout the Six Nations. But I think if they deliver this weekend, the Grand Slam, I think it's ominous as well for the rest of the world, because the younger players are just going to feed off that going into their home World Cup, and they can show that they can handle the pressure.
So do you think they will, though? Like, that's the question, really.
I think they will. I just think, like, England are definitely capable of beating them, but I just think England have been so poor throughout the Six Nations, despite what Eddie Jones is trying to get everyone to believe. I think their attack looks muddled. England are going to have to score tries to beat France. They're not going to, I would be shocked if they'd be able to kick their way to victory. France are certainly going to score tries, particularly at Paris. So I just don't see where England's tries are going to come from. They've changed it up again. They've brought George Furbank into their team for this weekend at fullback, and yeah, put Freddie Stewart onto the wing, and they still have Jack Knowles. So they essentially have three fullbacks playing in their back three. All those guys can comfortably play fullback. So it tells you a lot that England are expecting a kicking game against France. But I don't know. My sense was France weren't at their best against Wales, but like, you think back to all Grand Slam winners, you never have five perfect games. And they just had to get over that, and they did. They did just enough to win. But I think going back to Paris, and like I said, I just got a sense when I was over there that this team is seriously moving in the right direction, and with the public behind them. But that said, it can change so quickly. I don't know if you saw, was it last weekend or during the week, Lionel Messi getting booed by the PSG fans. Yeah. Like, the rugby crowd are a bit like that too. When things don't go well, the crowd get edgy, more so than any other crowd in the world. So if England could get on top early on and make it edgy, the crowd could start a bit, you know, you never know kind of what happens. So like I said, it's a strange scenario when you have Irish supporters running out of the Aviva Stadium on Saturday looking for the nearest TV to cheer on England.
Big time. Yeah, there'll be everyone will be stuck around the Aviva for the whole evening. What about the under-20s? I mean, they've been so impressive. Huge game for them against Scotland this weekend too.
They've been outstanding. I mean, the under-20s do tend to fly under the radar, and I've been a little bit surprised that maybe that the fact they're going for a Grand Slam this week has flown under the radar as well. It hasn't been done. They'd only be the third ever Irish team to win a Grand Slam. The last time they did it was in 2019 in Colwyn Bay in Wales, and I was over at that, and God, there aren't too many more grim places in the world to watch rugby than Colwyn Bay in North Wales, let me tell you, on a cold Friday night. So the game is already sold out this on Sunday at Musgrave Park. Like, it's sold out a week in advance. Like, there's serious like anticipation for moving the games to Cork. Has been such a brilliant decision because the Cork public have just bought into them. But not much was expected of this team. They're not a team, I would say, full of potential superstars like your James Ryans or your Gary Ringrose, but they are incredibly solid as a unit. Not the biggest pack either, but like, they've played to their strengths, and like, Richie Murphy has come in as head coach and really continued the good work that Noel McNamara had done and Nigel Carlin before him. Because for anyone who doesn't watch the under-20s, like, tune in on Sunday and watch them. The style of rugby that they play is superb. None of this kind of up-the-jumper stuff like the Lions were trying to play in South Africa. And this Scotland team have lost every game so far. They've lost all four games. So again, without getting too far ahead of yourselves, like, the Grand Slam is there for the taking. And if Ireland play anything like they've been playing over the last few weeks, then history is theirs.
Well, you've certainly sold it to me, Cian. Okay, we're going to take another very quick break, and then we're back with Colin McShane and Conor Whelan.
RTE 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. To celebrate 30 years of the Allianz League, six counties will wear once-off retro jerseys inspired by those worn in the first season of Allianz's sponsorship of the competition. The kits will be worn this weekend by Tyrone and Mayo in football, along with Galway, Clare, Wexford and Cork in hurling. Fans can enter a draw to win a signed retro jersey, with all proceeds going to Allianz's charity partner Women's Aid. The draw can be found at www.idonate.ie/raffle/Allianz Women's Aid. So a little bit earlier, I spoke to two Allianz League ambassadors, Tyrone's Cathal McShane and Galway hurler Conor Whelan. We'll hear from Conor Whelan shortly, but first I started by asking Cathal McShane about the current impasse between the GPA and the GAA over player entitlements.
Game on.
Gaelic football.
Cathal, first of all, I wasn't sure if you're going to be here with the GPA stance at the moment. Is it something that you're supporting?
Yeah, well, I think obviously, I think the thing about this was it was around match day ban. So I think that was obviously at the weekend there with the games and stuff. So I know at the minute, the reps are working within the squads and the GPA in order to get come to an agreement on this and get what was agreed at the start. I think it was something like last year when we did the COVID and stuff, there was cuts and stuff, and the players were very happy to facilitate and participate in that because obviously the difficult times you're in. But I think then there's an agreement put in place that once normality resumes, then, you know, we go back to the way it was, that, you know, we'd be covered for sessions and all the rest. So, I think the players and the reps and the captains are working together to get an agreement on that.
It was around match day the weekend, but then Wexford cancelled their media day. So there was a lot of curiosity about how that would play out with other teams and other events. Just in terms of the status of the GAA and the fact that they think that four training sessions is what players should be doing and what they're happy to stand behind, is that something, like, would you be doing more than that? Do you think that that's adequate?
There's definitely times being honest, there's definitely more times that I've been training more than that per week. And that's just probably the stage of the year that you're at and where you're at with the team and what the plans are and stuff. And obviously championship time, and just depending on where you're at, players too are different stages. So maybe more developed players when you're in. Some of the new players might have to do extra sessions as well, to get up, maybe it could be physical or whatever, things like that. So there's just lots of different things to consider. But for myself, there's been loads of times, that I've been training more than four times a week.
And how do you find that with work? Because burnout and, the amount of time that you guys have to give to everything that goes with Gaelic games and trying to balance has something that's been under the microscope for quite a while. And how do you find it?
Yeah, it can be tough at times, definitely. And obviously with work and the Keystone Group, there's a lot of planning that has to go on with both my work and my football. And then it's not even that, it's just your family and your friends and your social life as well, trying to fit it all together. But I do know that it does take a lot of planning to just make sure that you're on top of it, and that, because at the end of the day, you want to be giving your best to for Tyrone when you're playing. So you don't want anything else to affect that. So there's a lot of planning takes place, but we just need to make sure we do that in order to get the best out of ourselves.
How much more or less would you find that you do compared to when you're in Australia?
Well, I was out there for 2.5 weeks, very competitive environment, and their possibility from them. It probably helps too with them because they're professional. They can go in early mornings and stuff. Sometimes I would suggest that even from looking at it, that from chatting to the guys out there, that we train as hard, if not harder, And that's kind of, it's proud to say that too from a GAA point of view.
I feel like I'm coming at you with all the hard questions today. Darren McCurry has hit the headlines today for a number of reasons. And one, I suppose, that's really standing out is the fact that he's quite critical of all the players who've walked away from the Tyrone setup. He feels like that they've taken the easy option. What are your thoughts on it?
I haven't seen Darren's interview or haven't heard anything on it. But, different things happen, people, and in their own lives and private lives, things come on board and different things. So I know a few of the guys had tough decisions to make, but from knowing them personally and knowing them very well, I know how much they bring to the squad, how much they bring to the setup, and I do know that they could have made us a serious a better team this year as well, because if they were back in and competing to start, to be getting the starting jersey, just that competition's healthy. But now look at our team at the minute. some new faces in. The competition at the minute's very, very, you know, it's big in Gravahe every Tuesday, Thursday, wherever night you're up there, Saturdays, matches and different things. You know, you're always trying to drive each other on, whether it's in the gym or whether it's the pitch. And, you know, at the minute, we have a good setup there. We have a good squad of players. So we're happy with that. But no doubt those guys that stepped away, they could have made a massive impact this year as well.
Do you have enough depth, do you think, like just in terms of six is quite a lot to lose, like, for a training session,
well, that's it. It definitely is. But again, we've had others that have stepped in, come in. We've introduced new faces, and that's no different than any other year. Every year, you always introduce new faces, and you know, new guys come, and that's just the way football is. You know, people get older, and maybe boys performing well at minors or under 21s. They get their opportunity to come in and showcase what they're about. So. You know, at the minute we have a good squad there, and as I say, the competitiveness it needs to be there, because it drives everybody on, and it just gets the best out of us. So we just need to continue to do that going forward.
How are you feeling about the season so far in a relegation battle? I don't think it's anywhere. I don't think it's where people would have expected you to be.
When you look at it, it has been obviously up and down. There's been lots of good stuff, more probably downs than ups, being honest. But I think from last year, probably took a lot out of us in terms of, you know, getting through the year and then just going away to your clubs. We went back to your clubs, and that ran in maybe, I know for myself, mid-November, December time. So you only have maybe a short break off before you're getting to go again. And this year's probably been, you know, we've been up, because it's a shorter season, we've been, you know, getting up to speed, trying to get up to speed, a lot quicker maybe than any other year. So we know at the minute we haven't been at the levels required, and we know that we do need a big improvement going forward. But from knowing the lads and knowing my teammates, you know, we will be working ever so hard to make sure that we can get up to that standard and bring the energy and bring everything that we need, and it needs to start this weekend.
How do you feel that the forward units are going at the moment, the forward unit?
We're going well. We're working hard and tuning, and we're striving to get the best out of ourselves. Now, every day you go out, will it come off? What do you plan, or you know what's there? Maybe not, but it's a lot to do to how the opposition set up, and you have to factor in a lot of things. You know, Dublin at the weekend, you know, they frustrated us in terms of getting a lot of numbers back. You know, so the spaces were limited, but. You know, when you go in and review that, we know that going forward we need to be very, very sharp up front, and we need to be working together and driving the thing on. So, you know, it doesn't come from, you know, just on the match day. It's what we do away from it, what we work hard towards. So we'll be doing that now going forward to ensure that we're performing better as the games come by.
They're coming thick and fast. And there's another one now this weekend, a big one as well, against Mayo. Probably a good one to test yourselves and come out with the win, really, and, you know, kind of get everything back on track.
Well, that's it, because obviously you look at Mayo last week, 1 point defeat to Kerry. So again, a tight battle there. And they're probably coming in, you know, they're coming in stronger than they were last year. For us, it's a matter of, we know that we need to get a reaction from last week. We need to improve our performances and start to look up. And as I say, this weekend, there's no better time to do that.
Game on.
Gaelic football.
Now, that was Cathal McShane there. I also caught up with Galway hurler Conor Whelan.
Game on.
Hurling.
The championship's going to come around really quickly, though, and it's such a compressed season. You'll actually be able to take a summer holiday this year if you want to in August. How do you feel about it being so compressed?
I suppose, obviously, there was issues with the whole structure in terms of... You know, it was very, very difficult on the club players, and I suppose it was tough as well for us to be going back to our clubs and then coming back to our county again, and it's very much so broken, and there's no restructuring it. So, yeah, I think it's great they have it, I suppose, split in half and have it condensed so that, you know, I suppose we're very, very aware of, I suppose, our fixtures, and very aware of when the season starts and finishes, and, you know, the club players, I suppose, are very aware of, I suppose, when their season starts as well. So I think it's fair for everyone, I suppose.
Does it add a kind of a different element having somebody like Henry Shefflin in charge, somebody that you would have grown up watching and seen as being one of the greatest players to ever play the game, now managing you?
Yeah, look, at Henry's always been, I suppose, somebody that all of us younger generation, I'm going to call myself young, looked up to and aspired to be like, and yeah, you know, obviously it's a massive, I suppose, privilege for us as players to have Henry there. And, you know, I suppose it's a lot of the focus is on Henry and stuff like that. But I think, you know, it's very much so down to us as players, I suppose, to improve and develop and obviously perform in games. And that's very much so our focus, I suppose, really.
People are fascinated by him, though, and, like, just want to know what kind of a coach he is. Like, is he hands-on? Is he, like, a tracksuit manager? Like, what kind of an impact does he have on a session?
Obviously, he's the manager, and he's surrounded by his management team. So, he, you know, they obviously work very, very close together. And, you know, as I alluded already, it's very much so an honour. And, you obviously try and do your best. And, that's pretty much it. So,
but does he, like, if you're doing something wrong, will he come in, like, and take the hurley off you and show you what to do? Is he that type of, the way Mick O'Dwyer would have stopped a game and said, right, well, this is what you should be doing? Like, is he that hands-on? Like, do you have Henry Shefflin telling you whenever you're doing something what to do? Is he that way as a manager?
To be honest with you, I think, you know, most management teams nowadays are kind of similar in that, I suppose you review a game as a squad and as a management team, and, you know, through the use of your analysis, you pick out areas that you did well and areas that you need to improve on. And that's very much so the model that Henry's management team are using. So I don't think it's Mick O'Dwyer-esque or anything like that. So
what you're saying is, if I want to know, I'm going to have to climb up a tree and look for myself.
basically.
What have you learned from him, though? Like, what kind of things are you learning from him?
I think Henry, Henry's a very, very passionate guy, and we're very aware that, I suppose, last year that, I suppose, our performances just weren't good enough. And I think not really that you're learning, but I think, you know, we as players are very aware, I suppose, that our performances weren't good enough, and that's something that we're trying to, I suppose, put right. And Henry's the manager at the end of the day, and he's not stepping across the white line with us. So, I think we're very much so focused on trying to improve and develop, and that's very much so part of our focus, and that's something that we're working with Henry and his management team to do, I suppose, really.
Obviously, there's no Joe there anymore. Does the dynamic change when a big leader and a big player like that leaves a setup?
Yeah, look, but obviously Joe was up there with the greatest players that ever played the game. He's an unbelievable character, unbelievable person, and the same with Aidan Hart. Aidan Hart was a massive character in the dressing room and a huge leader as well. And I suppose any time these players step away, there's obviously a period of transition, and you're, I suppose, trying to afford opportunity to younger players and players, I suppose, that have been on the fringes to come through. And that's very much so our focus as a team and over the course of the league, is trying to transition and trying to, I suppose, help players to build those roles, I suppose, really.
So just in terms of the Clare match, how are you feeling?
Feeling good. Yeah, look, obviously, you know, Clare are a very, very good side, and, we're hoping to have a performance at the weekend and, our home ground and in front of our fans and for Easter Championship. So, yeah, look, hopefully we'll be able to perform.
And just finally, the GPA stance at the weekend, we didn't see too many of the intercounty players or managers talking. Just, is it something that you support?
Obviously, there's a lot being said and a lot going on in terms of the GPA. And obviously, I suppose, looking at cap and the amount of sessions and stuff like that. And, as I suppose, obviously the GPA have taken the consensus of all the players and felt that that's an unfair thing to do. And the other aspect is about only paying 32 players on the panel, even if there's 40 on the panel. So I suppose there are definitely issues. And I think, you know, every player deserves to be treated the same. Equality is something that's very, very important. And, I think players shouldn't be out of pocket, particularly players who are in college, paying $2,000 for car insurance and then driving to sessions and with the possibility of not getting paid. And, obviously cap and sessions and stuff like that, that's a whole different argument, really. That's something that needs to be discussed with management teams and with the GA and stuff like that. We're just players, and we just go, regardless of if it's five sessions or two sessions a week, we just go wherever it's on, and we show up and train as best we can and go home again. So yeah, hopefully it'll be resolved soon. And yeah, to be honest with you, it's just something that I suppose should be sorted, really.
Conor, thank you so much for joining us, and we will no doubt talk to you soon.
Game on. Hurling.
Now, that is all we have time for on the show this evening. Kian Tracy, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me, Marie.
You'll come back?
I will, if I'm invited.
We'll have to get you talking about all the other sports as well. How many did we get you doing today?
I know, enough. Yeah, sorry if I talked too long.
Hurling, horse
for you,
racing, yeah. Rugby. Expert on everything. Right, Tara Kumar is up next.
RTE 2FM.